For Christians, we are summarizing what we've learned, and so far what we've seen is, on one hand, we're told that the Old Testament law is holy, it is good, it's not a law of bondage, it's a law that actually gives freedom. It's a law that draws men and women closer to Jesus. But we've also seen that when the New Testament age opens, that there are some changes, that some of the ceremonial laws aren't practiced anymore. And so we're trying to reconcile that with what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount about not a jot or tittle will pass away from the law. And what we looked at, what we said last week, is that in the deepest sense, the ceremonial law is not abolished. Some of the practices do go away, but the things that the ceremonial law taught still apply. They're still true. So, for instance, the ceremonial law, I would claim, probably the most important thing it taught was that God is holy and that to approach God requires condescension on God's part. That's still true. It requires God to take the initiative. God is holy and we are not. And so part of God's condescension, part of God making a way for us to come to Him is the sacrificial system. Because the ceremonial law teaches that sin requires death on the part of the sinner. It requires blood. And that's still true. We don't kill the animals ourselves because Jesus has been killed in our place. But the truth of the ceremonial law is true, still true. And in fact, when we realize it's not just a lamb that has to be killed, but the very Son of God, that makes, in some ways, the ceremonial law even stronger. So, where was I? It was right about to talk about the dietary laws. So, here's what I want to say about the dietary laws. Here's another example where the law seems to be changed. And it certainly is, in at least a superficial way. Shellfish, for instance, is no longer prohibited. We can have bacon. Gentiles are not to be considered unclean. But let's take a look at a passage that speaks about this. One of the great passages is Acts chapter 10. And let's see, we'll read just, it's a long passage, we'll just read one verse in a minute. But you remember the story. There was a man, a Roman soldier, Cornelius, described as a centurion. A centurion was a fairly important army officer in those days. He commanded a group that's, the Latin word is centurion, so you think it'd be 100, but of course it was actually 60. Go figure. But anyhow, he commanded a group of men, you know, sort of roughly equivalent to a company in the U.S. Army. And so in a sense, he'd be more like a captain. But relatively speaking, he'd actually be a much higher ranking officer. The centurions were usually the highest ranking career officers. The officers above centurion were all politicians, which makes you wonder, how on earth did these people conquer the world? But that's another story entirely. Cornelius was a devout man who feared God with all his household, gave alms generously to the people, and prayed continually to God. When it says he feared God, that's actually a technical term. God-fearer was a technical term for a Gentile who embraced the Jewish faith in every way except circumcision. So someone who embraced the Jewish faith and, in the case of a man, underwent circumcision would be a proselyte. We learned, or you will learn, in the second service, of a man, a proselyte, who became one of the original deacons. But there were a class of people, class of men, who didn't go that final step. They embraced Judaism in every way except circumcision, but they were given this specific technical title of God-fearer. And Cornelius was one. And as it says, he backed up his faith in the Jewish religion with acts. He gave alms generously to the people, i.e. the Jewish people, and prayed continually. And he sees this image, this vision, telling him to summon Peter. And at the same time, Peter is having this vision, which the blanket is the sheet is set down with full of unclean foods. And Peter says, oh, no, I have nothing to do with unclean foods. And God says in verse 15, what God has made clean, do not call common. This happened three times. And finally, Peter gets it. And so he, when the summons arrives from Cornelius, he comes, he preaches the gospel, and Cornelius is converted. This is the beginning, really, of the great Gentile ministry. And Peter, who's had some time to reflect on this, he says to the household, this is beginning of verse 28, and he said to them, you yourselves know how unlawful it is for a Jew to associate with or to visit anyone of another nation. But God has shown me that I should not call any person common or unclean. So when I was sent for, I came without objection. And then actually, there's the preaching of the gospel and so on. And Cornelius and his household turned to God. Well, the reason I read this is because of particularly verse 15. What God has made clean, do not call common. I think that is the key. There's another passage in the Gospels where it says, in saying this, Jesus declared all foods clean. So the difference there, the change, isn't so much that God said, you know, I don't really care about whether you eat unclean foods or not. What he said is, what God does at the New Testament age, is say, I'm cleansing these foods. I'm changing not the law, but I'm changing the objects. What the law taught was that there was such a thing as clean and unclean. Distance from God. Distance from people who don't follow God. And that was prefigured, that was shadowed, that was taught through dietary laws, part of the ceremonial law. And what I'm claiming here is that all those principles still apply. God's people are to be separate from sin. God's people are to realize that God is holy and that one approaches God with care. And particularly, one approaches God the way God tells you to do. You don't just presume on his presence and presume that you can just sort of bop on into his house anytime you feel like it. You can do that. You can come into God's house because God has invited you. God has cleansed you. God has taken away your sins at terrible cost to himself. And that's why his people can come into his house. But not because God doesn't really care about what you do when you come into the house. So I would argue that the dietary laws still mean something for us. They still mean that clean and unclean matter. They're not expressed through foods, but they are expressed, even more importantly, through behavior. And they are expressed through our associations. This, of course, becomes a challenge. You recall that Paul later elsewhere says, I didn't tell you to dissociate yourself from all sinful people. Then you'd have to go out of the world. He's actually talking about Christians who are living in sin. He says, separate from them. But people who need the gospel, you go out to them all the time. And so it's not the easiest thing in the world, perhaps always, to understand or to practice this. But I think the things are that the ceremonial law taught are still true. Now, don't want to talk about that. So, here's a quote from John Calvin on these matters. This is from his commentary on the harmony of the Gospels. Calvin didn't write individual commentaries on Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He wrote one long commentary on the three of them together. And this is from that commentary. He says, as for doctrine, we must not make out that there has been any abrogation of the law in Christ's coming. For as the rule of holy and devout life is eternal, it must be unchangeable. And likewise, God's justice is one and constant, as he composed it therein. So you might be thinking to yourself, okay, that's true of the moral law, and it is. But Calvin goes on. As regards ceremonies, if we allow that they may be reckoned somewhat incidental, it is only their practice that was abrogated. Their significance was actually given more confirmation. So Christ's coming did not take anything away, even from the ceremonies, but rather the truth behind the shadows was revealed and served to strengthen them, seeing the concrete fact we recognize that they were not vain or useless. The ceremonies were not vain or useless. And so, I think I've got Calvin on my side here. Our Westminster Confession talks about ceremonial laws in a passage I read the other day. This is chapter 19, paragraph 3. He says, all which ceremonial laws are now abrogated under the New Testament. All right, I think this is true as far as it goes. But if I were allowed to tweak the confession, and no one's asked me, actually, but if I were, I think it would be better to say that the literal observance of many of the ceremonial laws has ceased or has been changed, but the significance of the ceremonies still remains. I'm just trying to be more precise and avoid the danger of saying, well, the law just gets completely swept away. If you've gotten anything out of this, I hope you're getting the fact that saying that the law is just swept away, or any part of the law is just swept away, is not an option, in my opinion, because Jesus makes it clear that can't possibly be true. And so when the confession says the ceremonial laws are abrogated under the New Testament, I absolutely agree if they're thinking in the way that Calvin did, and I think they were, actually, when he says it is only their practice that was abrogated, their significance was actually given more confirmation. So that's about it for the ceremonial law. There are lots of questions that could be asked and a few questions that could be given, but I think that's sort of the overall way I would approach it, and I think there's certainly room for study. As I've been studying on this, I realize that one of the reasons there's room for study is that so many Christians, particularly since the rise of dispensationalism, have been taught to blow off large chunks of the Old Testament. And we need to make up for lost time here. We need to take that part of God's law more seriously. And in the Reformed world, we're doing more of that and making progress. But there's still a lot to figure out. There's laws whose understanding is not very clear to us, and how we would practice them today is not very clear. But there's work to be done. Dr. Over. Mm-hmm. Right. Good point. Okay, any other questions on this? The next thing we're going to talk about is the civil or judicial law. So I scan the room. I see no comments. So let's talk about the civil law. We say civil today. I think the other day I told you I prefer judicial, and I'll explain why I prefer the term judicial as you go through. But here are some preliminary considerations when we think about the judicial law, particularly as we find it in the Old Testament. The first thing is that civil law or judicial law is moral. It is different from what is usually called moral, not necessarily in its content. It's different because it's enforced by the state. And that's why I like the term judicial better, because it puts the emphasis on judgment, the way the state executes judgment upon lawbreakers, is really what's under consideration here. This is important because you will hear people say a tremendously silly thing. You'll hear people say you can't legislate morality, and I hope that at least with a little reflection you realize that's all you can legislate. People legislate precisely because they think certain behavior is moral and certain other behaviors are immoral. We may not agree with their estimation of which ones are moral and immoral. But when the state legislates something, it's because it thinks it's wicked not to do what the state wants you to do. Whether it's something like a speed limit. I mean, if you break a speed limit, you will give up money. If you break some other law, you'll give up your freedom. And if you break some other law, you might give up your life. And all of this is because the state considers it immoral not to do the things that it legislates. We may not agree so much with every category, but in fact, we may figure that a lot of what the state legislates is positively immoral. But you break a law, and you will discover very quickly that the government considers its laws highly moral, and a violation of its laws to be highly immoral, and so on. So the civil law isn't so much different in its content, but it is different in that it describes the penalties that the state applies. All right, so that's the first consideration. Actually, that's the second one, too, I just noticed. My second point was all legislation is about morality. I just said that. So the question isn't so much, should we legislate morality? That's all we're going to legislate. But we do have these questions. Whose morality should the state enforce? Whose set of rights and wrongs ought to be the set that the government enforces, that the government makes normative for its citizens? This is becoming a very live question for us. You know, 20 or 30 years ago, we might have had one set of concerns about what the law, what the government should enforce. And nowadays, we have another set, and you know, it's the rise of Islam. And it's the rise of Islamists moving into traditionally Christian countries, the West, Europe, and the United States, and insisting that at least Muslims within those countries should only be governed by Muslim law, by Sharia, and that they should not be subject to the laws of the nation. So if you are a Muslim living in, let's say, the Netherlands, the claim is, I should not be subject to Dutch law. I'm only subject to the Sharia, and therefore killing my daughter because she dated somebody I don't like, because she dated somebody, is perfectly legitimate. And the Dutch laws against killing people, at least without their consent, those don't apply anymore. They don't apply to me. And you hear people saying the same thing in the United States. You see important people saying, well, you know, maybe we should let Muslims be governed by Sharia law in the United States and not under our laws. And so another example, of course, would be divorce. Polygamy would be yet another one. Polygamy is actually at least parallel polygamy. Simultaneous polygamy is still outlawed in the United States, even in Utah. But, of course, Muslims are allowed to have up to four wives. Well, do we enforce our laws against polygamy on a Muslim living in the United States? There are more and more Muslims saying, are you know, standing up and saying, no, you shouldn't. And there are a lot of non-Muslims who are beginning to cave and say, well, you know, maybe in the interest of multiculturalism and not having our heads cut off, we should just cave to them. So anyway, this is becoming a real live issue. It's an issue in a very sharp way. Whose morality should the state enforce? Another question is, how much of that morality should the state enforce? You know, back in the good old days, when we knew it was going to be Christian morality, we still had the problem of, well, how much of that morality should the state enforce? There are some that were obvious. Everybody said, you know, obviously Christianity says murder is wrong, and frankly so do most other religions, so the state will enforce laws against murder. There was a time when people said, well, divorce is wrong. Divorce is a bad thing. And so when the state regulates divorce, the state should do so in a way that shows deference to the biblical law. And so, for instance, it used to be in many Western countries that you couldn't get a divorce unless you could prove that one of the parties had committed some kind of sin. In British law, and of course, you know, the Church of England is much stricter on the question of divorce and remarriage than, say, the Westminster Confession would be, and the most evangelicals today, or most evangelicals 50 years ago, the Church of England is very strict about that. It used to be that sometimes this would mostly be rich people. Rich people can do all sorts of things because they have the resources. But rich people wanted to get a divorce, and neither of them had committed adultery, which was the only way you can get a divorce in an English court. So they would actually get somebody to perjure themselves and declare, yep, I had an affair with so-and-so, thereby allowing the court to declare a divorce. And sometimes there may have been an affair, but there were times, as I've read it, that actually the person would just claim to have had an affair to meet check off the requirements for a divorce against English law. Nowadays, of course, we have no-fault divorce. Now, divorce is regarded by the state as a regrettable thing. No one thinks it's a, well, I shouldn't say no one thinks it's a happy thing. But we it's a suboptimal outcome. But there's certainly no sense that anybody is to blame or that you need to prove you have a good reason for a divorce, certainly prove the kind of reason that biblical law would require. And then, so now we have, even people who would sort of accept some Christian ideas would say, well, maybe we don't enforce any Christian understanding of divorce. You want a divorce, you get one. And then one last example is the Sabbath. You know, most of us can scarcely remember or know anybody who could remember when Sabbath laws were enforced. Every so often you'll hear a news story about, silly laws like eating ice cream on a Wednesday on the sidewalk or, some bizarre thing like that. But, most of us have no knowledge of the blue laws, the laws that would have forbidden certain things that were always based on the Sabbath. They seldom said, you must go to church, but they might say, the bars have to close. I'm a hockey fan, so you're going to have to listen to this. In Canada is a country that's strongly influenced by British Christianity, and Toronto was particularly influenced by Presbyterianism. Toronto had pretty strict blue laws. They used to call the city Toronto the Good. And what it meant is that certain kinds of activities, particularly certain sports events, were not allowed on Sunday. And so in Canada, the big hockey game was always played on Saturday night. The Toronto Maple Leafs always played at home on Saturday night against somebody else. And so the big Canadian radio show, which then became the television show, it's the longest running television show in North America, is Hockey Night in Canada. And that was always on Saturday afternoon, late afternoon, because that's when the righteous people played hockey. Now, the wicked French Canadians, Montreal, they played on Sunday. But what do you expect? They're French Canadians. They're Catholics. But the good Protestant Maple Leafs always played on Saturday. And when it got to be playoff time in hockey, they had this thing called sudden death overtime. You just keep playing until someone scores. And in the olden days, before they learned how to resurface the ice, and the ice just got worse and worse as you played on it, if a game was tied into overtime, it sometimes went on for a long time. And they'd have problems because they'd be a little afraid that the game, no one might score before midnight. And if someone didn't score before midnight, they'd just have to shut that game down and restart it on Monday because they weren't allowed to play on the Sabbath. Well, those days are over. But again, in Canada, still, Saturday night is hockey night. When did that change? I don't... in some ways it didn't change, because as I said, it's still Saturday night hockey. Even actually when they were playing Saturday night hockey, they were having wrestling matches on Sunday. But, wrestling is practically pagan, so he says with a tongue in cheek. Another example. Actually, Pastor Rayburn mentions this occasionally. He mentions in Scotland, when he was in Scotland, he had a friend who loved Formula One auto racing. And it was in the early 70s that the British stopped running the British Grand Prix on a Saturday. In fact, I remember as a young boy, in the 1970, 71, the British Grand Prix was always on a Saturday. All the other races around the world were on a Sunday. But the British still ran their big auto race on Saturday. And it was about 72 or 73 that they started switching to Sunday. All right, well, obviously the question of should the state enforce the Sabbath is the kind of question that virtually all Christians say no to. It would be a huge change to many people. And in this case, I always think of Tom Landry. Anybody? That name ring a bell with anybody? Yeah, Tom Landry, the coach. I think wasn't he the first coach of the Dallas Cowboys and coach for many, many years during their glory years. He was a committed Christian. He had become a Christian, I think, later in his, you know, after his playing days with the New York Giants, and was a godly man. He was on the board of Dallas Theological Seminary, and he hated the Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders as a Christian man. But his job was the football side of the house. He wasn't given any input into the sex side of the house. But he was a man whose job was to break the Sabbath. Fortunately, the seminary on which he on whose board he sat was one that was probably most stridently against keeping the fourth commandment. We'll get to all of this in another lesson. But you know, so there was a godly man who had been taught, you know, by other people who loved the Lord, that the Sabbath didn't apply, and you know, his whole job, his number one day on the job was to break the Sabbath on Sunday, and you know, frankly, most Christians didn't think too much about it, and you know, particularly when you looked at a guy like Tom Landry, you know, Christian man, it must be okay. That shows basically just how far our country has moved from the day when the Sabbath actually mattered. I'm not aware of that it was ever played. I'll have to. Okay, one more hockey comment here. I grew up watching Bobby Orr, so my favorite hockey team is the Boston Bruins. But I am sorry to tell you that the ownership of the Boston Bruins, the early ownership, was a fellow who played a primary. He also owned a baseball team. I don't know if it was the Braves in those days or whether it was the Red Sox. But he played a primary role in getting baseball played on Sunday. And that was a long time ago. That was like the 20s or 30s, I think. And that was a shame. So it's been happening for a long time. So anyhow, the whole point of all this, though, is to point out that we have a question. How much of that morality should enforce? Even if we all agree that Christianity ought to be the baseline, how much of Christian morality should be enforced by the state? You all know, by the way, that of the Ten Commandments, nine of them are enforced by the state. But the tenth is not. The tenth is about coveting. And I think there's a number of reasons that commandment is given and why it's part of the summary of the ten. But I'm sure one reason is to, first of all, to remind us that there are sins that reach deep into our hearts that don't always show very well, and which it's hard for someone else to judge. You know, Connie and I were talking about this morning at the breakfast table, and you know, we were saying that, well, you are covetous. You want stuff. I, on the other hand, want to provide for my family. And of course, to provide for my family, we need a home in Palm Springs or whatever. You know, and the thing is, how do you decide? How do you decide when you've gone too far? That the Tenth Commandment is a very searching one. Dr. Rogland is not with us. He's in South Carolina at his winter home with his family. Dr. Rogland was famous when he taught at the high school for driving beaters, driving cars that were would shed parts as he would drive along. And Bob always used to say with a smile that another church member asked him once, "Bob, do you drive decrepit beaters out of principle or out of necessity?" He never actually gave an answer to that, and I think it may have been yes. Who knows? So how do you decide, you know, how much of a nice car you get? I don't know. But it's the kind of thing that makes you search your heart. And there's no way the government can decide that for you. But you all know, maybe you will now, that governments have tried to do that. Some of the Puritan governments in New England tried to deal with the Tenth Commandment. They're what are called sumptuary laws. And these were common in parts of New England. They're actually common in parts of Europe at different times. But these would be laws that would regulate the fineness of your clothes, how far the pointy toes of your shoes could curl, believe it or not. That was an important thing in one day. There were laws that tried to prevent people from displaying too much finery. Part of that was, I think, a 10th commandment issue. Part of it was trying to maintain harmony among the different classes, saying rich people shouldn't be so ostentatious, and so on. But it pointed out the problem that people had with the heart and their desire for things and their desire to show off that they had things. Kimberly. Well, it is interesting that income equality, or wealth inequality, rather, I should have said inequality both times. Inequality is a big issue. And there are people who say inequality is one of the biggest issues. It's a problem, and the government needs to reduce that. And you have lots of heated discussion about that. Another example is politicians trying to be humble, trying to talk about having grown up in a log cabin. I remember one politician who drove some sort of hybrid car, a little teeny hybrid car. And he boasted about he drove a little teeny hybrid car. Now, the fact is his garage was full of massive SUV gas guzzlers, but they weren't registered in his name. The family Learjet was not registered in his name because he had the wisdom to marry the ketchup heiress. Anybody with Google knows who I'm talking about now. But he acted some as if people would not know that in fact he did have a Learjet at home. He had a whole stable full of expensive cars, but he hid behind, as politicians and all of us do, the legalities of, well, they're not actually registered in my name. The only one that's registered in my name is the Prius or whatever it was. We actually live in a culture where we're against ostentatiousness. Many of us think that's... Well, no, even ourselves, even people themselves are sometimes careful. Obviously, there'll be changes to that, but situations where they don't mind showing off. But there is sort of a general feeling that you don't want to flaunt it too much. And if you do, you immediately start spouting off something about, well, I'm going to do something to give back to the community. Okay. All right. Well, it's my fault, but we're getting off here. So how shall the state enforce that morality? What I meant to say is, once we decide the state is going to say such and such an activity is wrong, how do you enforce that? Do you enforce that by the death penalty? In England, a couple hundred years ago, if you stole something, they chopped off your hand. We would think that would be too far today. Do you fine somebody? How much do you fine someone? Do you throw them in jail? For how long do you throw them in jail? All sorts of questions there. Some of these are questions of following the Bible. And Chuck Colson, by the way, I don't know if you've ever read him on this. Of course, Chuck Colson went to prison for his role in Watergate and so on, and then started Prison Fellowship. He had a real heart for people who were in prison. And he thought deeply about these things, and I remember reading an article by him many years ago that pointed out, as many people have, the whole concept of prison is not a biblical one. It's actually a fairly modern one. Up until fairly recently, states would only throw in jail political prisoners. Other offenders would be punished, maybe corporal punishment, maybe a fine, but typically jail was just a place for people awaiting the outcome of their case. And he was arguing that the idea of locking people up is a bad thing. It's a bad thing spiritually, and it takes away the chance for a person to to rehabilitate himself, to get some self-esteem back by living a right life. And he also mentioned, by the way, that it's based on a false idea. He points out that our word penitentiary comes from the idea of doing penance. It comes from a theory of crime that says people only commit crimes because they're temporarily deranged. And every criminal, if he had a chance to sit down and just think about what he'd done wrong, would change his mind. And so prison was a place for people to, well, have a timeout. It was a place for people to think about what they'd done wrong, because they would inevitably do right if you just gave them a chance to think about what they did. This was a popular belief among Christians who had a lower view of sin. There weren't a lot of Calvinists behind this. And, you know, this is an interesting area of discussion. How should the government deal with offenders? So anyhow, all of that is under the heading of the judicial law. And so those were all preliminary points. What do we do? What do we do with the fact that the Mosaic law, in fact, is full of judicial law? It's full of statements about what the government should enforce and how the government should enforce it. There is a third preliminary principle that I need to mention. And that is that the New Testament sees the state, in principle, as a servant of God. The state's role is to enforce good behavior, even to the point of deadly force, bearing the sword, as it says in Romans chapter 13, 1 through 7. The government's job is to punish evildoers and reward good. And, of course, that is said even in a day when the Roman government wasn't a very good example of this. Paul and Peter, who write the two passages that we typically refer to when we're thinking about these things, Paul and Peter had enough sense, had enough wisdom, had enough of the Holy Spirit to say that there is an abiding truth, even as the Roman Empire is violating, as so many nations, as so many secular governments do, is violating the charge that's been given by God. That doesn't vitiate the fact that the government has been given a role, has been given a charge by God to enforce good behavior and to punish bad behavior, and in some cases to punish it with death. So all those are preliminary factors, preliminary principles. Most Christians throughout history have held that the civil law was given just to the nation of Israel and was never meant to be binding on any other nation. So for a lot of people who hold that, they would say, well, there's no problem. It's not that the law has changed. It's just the nation that follows that law, a nation for whom that law was given, has gone away. So essentially, there's no problem. You're good. Okay. My wife is on call at the hospital, but she hasn't been called. Many have been called, but not her. There are others who say, well, maybe that's true, but still, the civil law of the Old Testament, of Old Testament Israel, enshrines God's wisdom for how a state should be governed. And so it does furnish guidance for framing modern civil laws. It's not binding, but it should be consulted. And this seems to me to be the point of view of the Westminster Confession. When it talks about the judicial law, it says, to them, the people of Israel, as a body politic, he gave sundry judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other nation now, further than that the general equity thereof may require. All right, that's a little convoluted, but basically the divines are saying, you don't just read the Mosaic Law into the Constitution of England or America, but there are general principles of right and wrong and of equity, of how much this crime should be judged and, you know, what the penalty should be. All those principles are relevant, and that they should be consulted in formulating the civil laws of a country. One other thing I want to bring up here. Sometimes when we talk about the civil law obliging only Israel, we can forget that the prophets actually do say a lot about other nations. And they will judge other nations, not just for the way they treated Israel. There's certainly a bunch of that. But they will sometimes judge other nations just for their own sinfulness, the way they treated their own people. An example that probably would be one of the most famous and well-known to us is Jonah. Jonah was sent to Nineveh, not because the Ninevites were oppressing Israel, and God is saying, well, you're doing bad to my favorite country, therefore you're wicked. He's sent just because they're doing wickedness. They're a society of wickedness. So, for instance, in Jonah chapter 1, verse 2, we read this. God says to Jonah, "Arise, go to Nineveh, that great city, and call out against it, for their evil has come up before me." And then when the word reaches the king of Nineveh, this is in 3:8, the king of Nineveh is convicted by the preaching of Jonah. And actually, we'll start in verse 7. He issued this proclamation: "By the decree of the king and his nobles, let neither man nor beast, herd nor flock, taste anything. Let them not feed or drink water." He's disturbed. He wants everybody else to be disturbed. Verse 8, "But let man and beast be covered with sackcloth, and let them call out mightily to God. Let everyone turn from his evil way and from the violence that is in his hands. Who knows? God may turn and relent and turn from his fierce anger so that we may not perish. The king of Nineveh realized that the country he governed, his society, was a society full of violence. And it sure sounds like it was from top to bottom. You know, his government may have had a say in it, but he seems to be saying, you know, we're all guilty. We all treat one another with violence. We all treat each other with evilness. And I've been told, on good authority, that God hates that, and he's going to judge us. And we need to turn from that. And, of course, the amazing thing is they did turn. There was a nation that turned away from its sin. And, again, there are many other passages, and the point of all that is to say that nations that weren't given the Mosaic Law are still obliged to keep at least the moral law. They are under judgment for that. And actually, I don't have time to go into it, but if you take a look at Romans 1 and 2, you'll see that Paul relies on the fact that a knowledge of good and evil is available to all people, and they'll all be judged based on the knowledge of good and evil they have. All right, I have a couple minutes left, and... anybody want to hear about theonomy? Okay. Well, here's the like 3-minute version of theonomy. If we need to, we can do a little bit more of this next week. But there's a position called theonomy, sometimes called Christian Reconstruction. It used to be really popular. It seems like it's faded a little bit. But this is a movement that holds that the civil law of the Old Testament should be the civil law for any state today, and that the civil authorities of any state are obliged to enforce the Old Testament law, applying the penalties laid down in the Old Testament. Two of the names that you might recognize, or two of the most famous names, would be Greg Bahnsen, who wrote a book called Theonomy. R.J. Rush Dooney, a book called Institutes of Biblical Law. There's actually two or three other names. Gary North is a name many people will recognize. I want to say just a couple things about theonomy. One is people who aren't familiar with this, and particularly aren't familiar with the Reform thinking about the law, they think somehow the theonomists are saying you can be justified by law keeping. That's utterly untrue. It has absolutely nothing to do with justification. Another thing that's a preliminary comment: theonomy obviously has a very deep conviction of the continuity between the Old Testament and New Testament. That's a hallmark of the Reformed world. And in fact, virtually all the theonomists I know are Reformed people. At least they started that way before they became Anglican or became one-man denominations. Theonomy is a Reformed plant in Reformed soil. Theonomy strikes a chord in a day like ours, when the moral degeneracy is all around us, when the government has decided not to enforce good laws and is enforcing bad laws, when government now has legalized homosexuality, declared that it is right. In fact, it is now criminalized in some ways. It has criminalized the expression of the opinion that homosexuality is a sin. You know, there's a lot of ways in which you're not allowed to say that anymore, which is just an amazing thing. Government is calling good bad and bad good, and it is saying you go to jail if you point that out. So the idea of going to the law of God is attractive with many people, and that's what is behind a fascinating thing. Again, I'm not sure if you are aware of this, but it's amazing there are a lot of Pentecostals and Charismatics who find theonomy very attractive. You know, they'd be the last people in the world, you think. And actually some dispensationalists have found some attraction to theonomy because they like the idea of God's law. They like the idea of turning to God instead of man, because man has been a great disappointment. Two other things I need to say. Theonomy tends to attract outspoken people with a violent vocabulary. It attracts some people that we might say are jerks. Having said that, I have to tell you, the only time I heard Greg Bahnsen speak in person, he wasn't foaming at the mouth. In fact, I thought he was very convincing. He was a kind and gentle man, at least in his speech. But some of these guys can be pretty violent, and of course some of their attackers can be pretty violent too. And so it's an area in which if you wade into it, you'll quickly find people who are not really good, perhaps, at doing controversy in a Christian way on both sides. One last thing that's important to point out. Theonomists do not advocate the imposition of biblical law upon an unwilling society by some armed minority. There aren't going to be these Bible stormtroopers running through the streets forcing you to keep the Sabbath. Their vision of the world is, first of all, they're post-millennialists. They have very optimistic eschatology. And what they're saying is, when the vast majority of the nation is Christian, this is how the laws ought to be done. And we will want to do them this way because the vast majority of the population will be Christian. Now, that means that theonomy is sort of just an academic exercise until we get there. It's sort of planning for the future, a future that may or may not come. But it's important to realize they're not advocating imposing theonomy by deadly force. I think I will have to just say a few more words next time we come together, what some of the issues I see with theonomy, and I don't have time to do that today. I think I'd rather take a few more minutes and do it justice next time around. So I think we're done for today. Thanks for coming.